For more than 400 years, people have reported seeing large, hair-covered, man-like animals in the wilderness areas of North America. The sightings of these animals continue today. Real or not, these reports are often made by people of strong character. What are they seeing? In a moment, we will talk about a Bigfoot investigation right here on Coast to Coast AM. Cliff Berrickman, he's from California. He's been a Bigfoot researcher for more than 15 years. Cliff owns two thermal imagers, spends most of his time in the woods trying to record thermal video of Sasquatches. He is currently relocating to Portland, Oregon to be closer to the field of Bigfoot research. He's with us for the next couple hours on Coast to Coast. Hey, Cliff, how are you? Welcome to the show.
I'm great. How are you doing?
Doing great. How did you get interested in the field of Bigfoot, the search for Bigfoot?
Well, I suppose it all started back when I was just a little kid. Like a lot of Bigfooters nowadays, it seems like most of us got hooked either by Boggy Creek or the Patterson film back in the 70s. I was born in 1970, so that puts me at a very impressionable age, you know, in 1976 when In Search Of and all that stuff was on. So I kind of I was hooked then. But when I was in college, I had about a 2 or 3 hour break in between classes. And I'd spend a lot of that time in the library reading, and I kind of stumbled across the section where they kept John Green's books and Grover Krantz's books and all that sort of stuff. And the more I read, the more I started realizing that, holy smokes, these things are real animals, not just like weird spooks or whatever. So I guess that kind of got me. And then back in the early 90s, in 94 actually, I started my first naive attempts to find the Patterson film site at the Bluff Creek. So ever since then, I've been in the woods every summer. So,
you know, I'm beginning to think that Sasquatch, Bigfoot, whatever it may be, it could be an offshoot of hominids that might have been, you know, between Homo erectus and where we are today as Homo sapiens.
Well, there's some problems with that. Some of that stuff is dealt with in Krantz's books rather well. Homo erectus, I believe, was, from what I understand, were not hair-covered. They were persistence hunters, like early Homo sapiens. And there, it seems unlikely that hominids, like a Sasquatch, would lose their hair, like Homo erectus, for example, and then regain it. And also there's some size problems with that as well. I think the closest to the mark so far that anyone's probably hypothesized is that Sasquatches are relic gigantopithecines, essentially.
Lauren Coleman, cryptozoologist, tends to believe that theory, too.
For lack of a better theory, it seems the most reasonable at this point. Of course, new data showing up might change our minds, but that's what science is about, isn't it?
Cliff, tell me about your technology and what you use out there in the field.
Oh, well, the BFRO, which is one of the groups that I participate in, has a backer right now that has supplied some of us with high-tech technology, pardon my redundancy. But I've been blessed with two thermal imagers. Basically, they see an infrared. Infrared light is basically heat that comes off of things. So when you're hunting nocturnal mammals, you know, these things, we produce heat. So that you could be given almost no better tool than finding nocturnal mammals than a thermal imager. And, of course, this is hooked up to a recordable DVR, so whatever the thermal imager is looking at is being recorded at the same time in digital format.
I've seen a couple of those pictures on the Bigfoot Research Organization's website, BFRO.net, and it's kind of interesting. I mean, because you get a full image of a creature. In this particular case, it looks like a deer that was shot and tested. But it's pretty remarkable stuff there, Cliff.
But what struck me when I first saw the deer, I was thinking, oh, look, you can see the hair color or something. And I realized, oh, no, I'm just being foolish. That's just a different part of the deer that's radiating more heat. So the hair patterns actually radiate different amounts of heat. And what I noticed when looking at humans, for example, through thermal imagers, is that their heads radiate so much more heat than the rest of their body. And we've started collecting images and video of various mammals, as many different kinds of mammals, including humans, as we can, because it's only a matter of time until we get Sasquatches on these thermal imagers. And it's going to be important to have, a database of all the different other animals out in the woods so we can compare, like, okay, this is a Squatch. It's obviously not a person because this is what a person looks like. Of course, I don't know who the volunteer is going to be filmed naked through a thermal imager as well. So, we're going to have a naked human on there because you can obviously tell when a human's wearing clothes through a therm.
Right.
But someone's going to have to be filmed naked. And
how close does a creature have to be to the thermal imager?
How close?
Yeah. Before it picks them up or picks it up.
I would think that the problem is if it's too far away, it's just going to look like a blob of light. I would say if the critter is about 150, well, I don't know. These things are pretty big. I wouldn't want to scan like the opposite side of a valley or something because you would just see a speck of light moving and you wouldn't be able to tell what it is. But basically, if you can see it like during daylight and you can tell it has arms and legs, you'll be able to tell it has arms and legs through the therms as well.
Okay, so if it's far away, you might not be able to determine what it is, but you know it's something alive, right?
If it's moving around.
Okay.
Rocks, it turns out that rocks radiate an amazing amount of heat all through the night, and I've been fooled several times by coming across a very strong heat source, and I actually had to stay on it for, you know, a minute or something just to see if it was going to move. And it can be a tricky thing because for everything I've heard about Sasquatches after talking to, you know, quite a few witnesses and reading everything I can and all that sort of stuff, Sasquatches are amazingly patient. So if one is hiding and crouching behind a bush or something, it probably won't be moving soon. In fact, there's a couple times on one of the BFRO expeditions up in Washington, a fellow researcher of mine, they had a Squatch approaching them down the hillside, and it was like breaking branches and screaming and doing all this sort of stuff. And my friend Bobo, I mean, he's been around forever. A lot of the listeners probably know who he is if they've, you know, seen some of the DVDs and whatnot out there. Bobo at this point was like doing aggressive calls to the Sasquatches, trying to get them all riled up. And he called to them, and this thing would scream and do all that sort of stuff back. And it came down behind some trees. And then Bobo let loose a series of, you know, aggressive howls at him, and the Squatch just stood there. And so Bobo decided that, well, I'm going to wait this thing out and see how long it took. And if I remember correctly, Bobo said it was over 20 minutes before they heard the thing walking away again.
Well, so, you know, Cliff, we get incredible stories from people who have witnessed Bigfoot walking across the roads, out in the fields, in the woods. I mean, just incredible stuff. These thermal imagers that you have, describe how they work and what do they look like? How big are they?
Well, I have two different units right now. One of them is I think Raytheon makes it. Thermal I-250D is the model number. You can look that up on the internet. But it's essentially the size of, say, a 1980s video recorder. So it's about maybe 12, 14 inches long, maybe 4 to 6 inches, you know, boxy square, like tall and wide. I don't use that one as a mobile unit very often. We have motion sensor DVRs that we use. So I try to choose a spot that would be most, like, for example, when I go camping at a lake or a meadow or whatever in a Squatchy area, I try to choose the spot that I would believe Sasquatches would observe me from, most likely. Where would the Squatch feel safest? And I focus the imager on that spot with the motion sensor DVR, so if there's any pixelation change in the field of view, the DVR automatically starts recording. So the larger unit I use as an all-night surveillance model, I guess, for lack of a better term. We also have smaller handheld units. I think they're 200Xs or something by the same company. And they look like small binoculars, but with one eyepiece, essentially. And we pipe those out into continually running DVRs. And you can either hold them with your hand or you can mount them on a helmet or something like that and walk around with them. It's a kind of a cumbersome setup, but it's the best that we've come up with so far for a mobile unit.
And you think thermal imaging is critical to the investigation, the search?
I think it's by far our most powerful tool. I think another great critical, you can do without it. I was talking to another investigator a few weeks ago, and he kept suggesting third-generation night vision piped into a recorder of some sort is the runner-up to therms. But again, if you're hunting nocturnal mammals that hide from you, I can't imagine a better tool than a thermal imager.
Could you determine the difference between a bear, maybe standing up, and a Sasquatch?
I think as soon as it moved, you could.
You could, okay.
Well, as soon as it moved, and Sasquatches would have longer legs. Their arms swing when they walk, and bears aren't exactly fluid.
Kind of cumbersome, aren't they?
Pardon me?
Kind of cumbersome, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they can walk around a little bit on their hind legs, but after talking to so many witnesses, almost every witness comments on the fluidity of the gait of the Sasquatch, and that would just be a stark contrast to that of a bear.
What are some of your favorite locations?
I go to Northern California quite a bit along the Klamath River. A lot of those smaller streams, whether it's Bluff Creek or any of those other ones that run into the Klamath, many of those, in my opinion, hold Sasquatches on at least some parts of the year. I've also been fortunate enough recently to start looking around in places east of the Rockies. I took my first trip out to Florida this past year with Matt from the BFRO and Wally from the BFRO. We went out to northeast of Tampa out there. And I've never been out that far anyway because I really don't go vacationing places unless there are Sasquatches there. I'm just kind of a Squatch geek.
You're one of the few people who wants to actually run into one, right?
Well, I'll keep my fingers crossed, you know.
What do people in these local areas say, Cliff, and I'm sure you talk to them, about
seems like you can
sightings?
Group them into a couple categories. There's one category that says, oh, no, those things aren't out there because I've lived here all my life and I've never seen one and I would have. Or there's the kind that say, oh, yeah, my aunt saw one. I've never seen one, but they're real. For example, I was out in Ohio back in May on a Squatch trip, and we were in a rental car, and we were going out to the field, and we got pulled over by a police officer. It was 3 a.m. Our taillights were out. Our headlights were on. I don't know why they make cars that, you know, the taillights can be out, but the headlights can be on.
You've got to check the bulbs once in a while, Cliff.
Yeah, I don't know. We just turned them on. We just flipped the switch or whatever, but we got pulled over at 3 a.m, and the police officer says, what are you guys doing? And we kind of looked at him and said, well, we're looking for Sasquatches. And he kind of cast us a sidelong glance and says, what? And he said, well, really? And we started showing him the therms. And we're very lucky because that police officer spent the next 45 minutes telling us about his 2 Class A encounters and all his friends who had seen or heard weird things in the woods. And we actually got a couple locations from him. So it seems like if the people out there have either had experiences and they know, or they have not, and so it couldn't possibly be real.
Pretty credible people. Northwest is probably one of the biggest areas for these sightings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say there's more sightings in the Pacific Northwest than elsewhere, although there are quite a few states giving the Pacific Northwest a run for their money nowadays, most notable probably being Ohio and Florida. Texas has a bunch of them down there. Even places you wouldn't expect, like Arizona, the higher mountain areas in Arizona, they have Sasquatches there as well.
Of course, what we're looking for is evidence, Cliff. We want to find the evidence. Have you folks collected anything from out there in the field?
The BFRO has come across the hair samples. We started equipping participants in our expeditions with handheld audio recorders, so you'll be seeing a lot more of those on our website over the next year or so. It takes a long time to go through 7 hours of forest noises and hope you got a Squatch on there, you know. So there's a lot of monitoring that we have to do. We have not got thermal image yet, but that's just a matter of time. Although we have had Class A sightings through thermal imagers that were not hooked up to DVRs. Right now, we actually have more thermal imagers than we have DVRs, which are the recording devices.
Have the hair samples been analyzed yet?
Dr. Henner Fahrenbach has looked at a number of samples, and last I heard, he had maybe 15 samples that didn't match any other North American mammal, but showed characteristics of hair of primate.
Well, it's just maybe a matter of time before you find this. Have you run into any cases where people say that they have a captured Bigfoot or they've shot a Bigfoot? Somebody named Buzz called us a long time ago and said that.
Yeah, there are a few stories here and there. I think a couple of them are actually on the database, the BFRO database. The one that comes to mind is an older gentleman, and I probably don't have all the details right. I believe he was up in Canada. I think it was during World War II. He's from an Eastern European country. He was poaching moose to keep his family alive, and he thought he saw one, shot it, but it turned out to be a squatch. It's a really intriguing story. It's on our database somewhere, complete with illustrations that one of our volunteers drew up. And I'm sorry, maybe that person's listening. I don't remember your name. I apologize. But yeah, so there's that story. I picked up another story about a possible shooting on the west side of Shasta, Mount Shasta, in the last couple years sometime. But I don't know a lot of the details about that. But yeah, those continually pop up. Whether they're real or not, I mean, I don't really know. It didn't happen to me, so I can't really say.
Okay, Cliff, so let's assume you're out in the woods, you've got your thermal imaging, you find something, and it's close. It's a creature. What are you going to do about it?
I'm going to do my best to film it. I'm going to do my best to film it, no matter what it takes.
What do your partners do?
My partners? They're right there with me. Basically, I depend on my partners for a lot, really, because I'm a musician. It's one of the ways I make money. So my hearing's not quite what it used to be. And like for Bobo, who I mentioned earlier, has fantastic hearing. He hears things 8 times out of 10 long before I do. So I really depend on my partners. But if there's one right there and I have a thermal imaging device hooked up to a DVR, I'm going for it. I've been out in the woods with a lot of people, many of which are listening right now, and any one of them would vouch for my dedication for that.
How close do you think you've gotten to finding a Bigfoot?
Finding? Well, I'll tell you how close I think I've gotten to a Bigfoot. The finding thing throws me off a little bit, but I believe on at least 2 or 3 different occasions, I've been as close as maybe 50 or 100 feet. Maybe closer, but I'm trying to be conservative here. So
that's pretty close. Could you smell him?
I've smelled Sasquatches on 2 occasions, but not at the same time that they were there, which is kind of curious. I actually didn't know what I was smelling at the time. One time I ran across the smell. This is in Northern California near the Siskiyou Wilderness area. The previous night, there were Sasquatches in the valley with us. In fact, I believe one of them came up to camp and screamed at us at 1:30 in the morning and woke us up, scared the hell out of me, honestly. And then the next day, I was walking around in the trails and looking for sign or whatever, and I ran across this small area, probably about 3 to 5 foot square on this trail, and I was walking past it, and it just stank. It just really stank. And then when I walked out of the area, I didn't smell it anymore, and I came back, and there it was in that one little area. And I asked a friend of mine who's had some close encounters with Sasquatches on a couple occasions and has smelled them very specifically. I said, well, what do these things smell like? I said, well, they kind of smell like, you know, like dog crap and like BO and all this other, you know, lovely things put together. And then this guy went on to say, but, you know, there's something really weird about the smell. It's very localized. It seems to be located in one small area, and you can walk through it. And they said, well, that's exactly what I just smelled, which is interesting. And then just, I think, about 2 weeks after I smelled that initially, I was out in the field in the Sierras with some other field partners of mine at a place in the Stanislaus National Forest, and I ran across the same smell that was associated with these trees, 2 or 3 trees, and actually Bob Strain is the gentleman who pointed out the smell to me, and it was the exact same smell that I smelled 2 weeks prior.
Like these things are rubbing against the trees, or they're clinging to the trees?
Who knows? In that particular case, I could see how maybe one rubbed against the tree. The first case up in Northern California, I don't know what it was doing because it was just a trail and this little area stank. So
all right, stay with us, Cliff. We'll be back with you and more, The Search for Bigfoot on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, our book, Worker in the Light, still available, Amazon.com or your favorite bookstores. Go ahead and pick it up and tell us what you think all about it. Amazon, of course, has really chopped the price of this thing. Worker in the Light, Bill Burns, me, and I hope you enjoy it. Matt Moneymaker, president of the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization, founded 1995. BFRO was the first national Bigfoot research organization. It's still the largest and most respected one of its type. The organization organizes field expeditions in the U.S., Canada, where clusters of sightings occur. These expeditions have yielded several sightings and numerous recordings of vocalizations. Matt Moneymaker with us as well. Hey, Matt, how are you?
Very good.
Good. Any relation to the poker player, Chris Moneymaker?
Yes, he's my second cousin.
He's doing well.
He is. He's actually gotten some good endorsements after he won that championship. And now people will ask, just like you did, any relation to Chris Moneymaker? Before, they just said, was like, is that your real name? It's actually an old German name. It was a translation of Geldmacher, which meant coin maker in the Middle Ages. And but it has a little bit different connotation now. But it was translated in the 1700s, and it's like shoemaker or Hittelmacher, a German occupational surname.
I love that.
But anyway, kind of a funny last name. No one would ever change their name to be that because it's just too strange.
Well, and you never forget it. That's for sure.
That's the only saving grace about it is people don't forget it.
You know, I was talking to Tommy earlier today about wanting to be a Bigfoot segment tonight on the show, and I yelled across this room and went, "Get Moneymaker!"
He did.
Your organization is highly respected. There are some that are not, but tell me a little bit about what you folks do.
Well, we were an organization that formed from kind of the group of people that had been exchanging information on Bigfoot stuff for a long time, long before the internet. And there wasn't that many of us years ago. Like, you know, for people in the 70s and 80s that had been writing letters to each other about sightings, and we'd hear about sightings, you know, we'd be excited if we heard one that had happened within the previous year. When the internet came along, we started exchanging information over that. There was a mailing list, and then there was a lot of people jumping on the internet who we didn't really want to be, you know, they call themselves Bigfoot researchers that we didn't exactly want to associate with because, you know, some of them were just crazy. And then other ones weren't crazy, but they didn't treat people very well. So that group kind of formalized under a banner, the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization, and created a website, et cetera. And it grew from there. And there was a lot of people who wanted to be involved, who wanted to take a look at sighting reports and investigate them. And we knew that there was people out there who had sightings and they didn't know who to report them to because the media didn't care, you know, would make fun of them. You know, back then, and even today, you can't just go, if you had a sighting and you went to your local newspaper or on television, they just kind of laugh you off. They wouldn't care. And then law enforcement didn't really care, and rangers. So as by default, people end up coming to us, and they've been doing so for years now, and I think they will continue to for a long time.
You recently had an expedition in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Tell me about that. How did it go?
It was very good. There was a heck of a lot of media attention about that. That one, and that was because in Michigan, the newspaper up there kind of got it out on the AP wire. It went very well, and the media, the unusual amount of media attention helped because we were able to get some information from witnesses who had recent incidents, you know, right before we got up there, and that led us to an area where we went out and did our thing, which is we have a technique where we go out and we make sounds similar to those that have been recorded and have been attributed to these things, and very often we will get responses. So it's responses in that if you were to go out and make sounds like coyotes, very often you get coyotes to answer.
Right.
Back
okay.
To you.
Okay.
So these things will operate the same way. If you're in the right place and you make the right sound, not only will they call back, but very often they'll come and check you out. They'll come nearby, and that had formed the basis for the expeditions ever since the Skookum expedition. And we've seen that now happen in so many different places that we know it works.
These sounds that we have here, Matt, that you've used in the past, we've had sounds of what we think are Bigfoot. I'm not sure that we've played on the program for years. I mean, it's like a howl, isn't it? Like a, something
that's
like
one. Well, that's one of them. there was a howl sound, and there'd be like the long moaning type howl, and it's different from a coyote sound. And usually the ones we have to, when people are telling us about responses they've heard, we have to distinguish it between initially from coyotes and sometimes even from owls.
Let me play you one here, Matt. Tell me what you think. I don't know if it's real or not. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a legit one.
You do?
Yes.
I hate to encounter one of those creatures then.
Yeah, and that wouldn't be the only one. I mean, in different parts of the country, they'll make different nuances of their howls, but it's, some of the qualities would be is you can tell that it's from an animal with a big lung capacity when you hear it. It's just the volume of it. Very often, and although you don't hear a long sustain in the clip that you played, very often that's a distinguishing feature in the howls they make. They'll just go on for longer than, say, a coyote can do.
What are they howling at and for?
They're probably howling to each other. Just like every animal, I mean, when an animal vocalizes, that's why they're doing it. They're trying to communicate something to another one of its kind. They're not just doing it just to get out to sing the blues.
So it's not an angry howl or something like that.
No, it's a communication. They don't have cell phones and emails, so they have to be able to reach out and connect with others that are doing their thing in the same area. They're hunting, gathering, etc. And they're communicating, and the way we know that is because sometimes we hear those sounds, and we'll hear something else further in the distance answering back.
I am convinced now, Matt, that something's out there. We have had and we've fielded so many phone calls over the years with people, incredible people. You can tell by their voices of incredible stories that, you know, they have spotted Bigfoot. And there was even one. I remember a woman called me a few years ago and talked about how her little kid would play with a baby Bigfoot, almost like they were friends. Now, that was an incredible story. Do you think that could have happened?
You know, it could have. But, you know, you'd have to expect that people are going to make up some stories. So I'm not suggesting that's what happened in that case, but when we've taken in reports over the years, we've been in a position where we could vet them. We could go through and figure out which ones are credible and which ones weren't. But there was just so many to start with. Even when we vetted out the ones that we just, with our most suspicious and cynical sense about them, we were left with some where it was obvious these people saw something. And it wasn't their imagination, and they obviously weren't lying. And I came from a legal background, and come from a family of lawyers and a law degree myself. And there's a simple principle, and I'd worked around law enforcement one time when I worked for the press in L.A. You knew that after a certain number of witnesses, it's obvious that there's something going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
And you don't find the same thing for. In other words, if people are all imagining this, if it was completely imaginary thing, there'd be all kinds of things that people would say. They'd see leprechauns, they'd see unicorns, they'd report all. They'd claim and absolutely believe that they had seen all sorts of things, and they don't. There's only a few classes of things that people have seen for, say, hundreds of years. It has a long history. Ghosts and UFOs fall in that category, too. It has a history thousands of years old. Lots of people claim they've seen them, and they'll continue to see them. And I think those are the characteristics for phenomena that actually do exist, but they're too unpredictable. I mean, first of all, you can't put them in a jar, any of those things, and bring them into a lab. They're difficult to capture, they're difficult to predict, and they're real difficult to subdue. And Sasquatches are one of them, but, very, very pervasive. It's got a long history, and people are going to be seeing them for a long time into the future. But they're never going to subdue them very easily.
Do you think, Matt, that they are more physical than some people have theorized as dimensional creatures, beings?
Well, I have a little bit of a unique insight into that.
All right.
I can tell you this. They're physical, no doubt about that. But there's things that happen when these things are around that would lend you to then, and there may be some unique capabilities in the animal kingdom, but I can understand why people would be led to believe that they might have some spiritual qualities. I mean, let's just say this. One, something's happened, you know, fall into the realm of sensations, let's say, that you get when they are nearby. Sensations that are very noticeable.
Intuitive sensations, you mean?
I don't know if they're intuitive, but let's just say, you know, some people call it infrasound. Some people, we don't know, you know, they say maybe it's caused by some kind of a subtle odor. But people will have physical reactions. Sometimes when they've heard them, walking, et cetera, nearby, where, you know, and people have seen them within, you know, a short time before. And people will describe some very unique feelings. I mean, very intense, like a, you know, a fear or, you know, kind of a skin crawling sensation, or that are associated with these things. And we think it's these things, one way or another, causes these sensations, and it may be some kind of a defense mechanism. But it doesn't mean that necessarily that they're shapeshifters or they're spiritual beings. But if you didn't know any better, if you were, say, from a primitive society and these things were around doing that, boy, you would think that they're pretty evil. It'd be easy to think that you were dealing with a spirit being.
In your professional opinion, what do you think these creatures are?
I think what I thought from the beginning, which was that Grover Krantz was right about what they are. I still think, and everything I've seen up until now leads me to believe that they are an extension of the wood ape line. He postulated that a long time ago, and I still think it's right on. If you look at the dispersion of sightings across the world, across the globe, they seem to radiate out of Asia. Not out of Africa, but out of Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And their size, and that would mean an Asian ape. Not an African one. Not Paranthropus, not a Robustus. It would probably something more related to, say, a wood ape or the orangutan line, specifically. And that's what Gigantos were. They're giant cousins to the orangutan. Also, the size. Any of the African apes, the humans, modern-day humans are the largest ones, I mean, in terms of height. You know, overall weight, mountain gorillas way more, but in terms of height, we're the biggest ones. These things are, the Gigantos are the only thing that we have in the fossil record that got anywhere close to the size of these things. You know, they were 9-10 feet tall, and that's what people report, and that's how big we think the large males are.
I saw a picture of one gorilla that was shot by poachers, and it was on the cover of one of the news magazines, and a sad story, but I got to tell you, the thing was huge. It had like 10 guys holding it up on two poles trying to carry this thing. Huge.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But they have short legs, and that's the difference. They don't walk upright. They don't really cut the silhouette that Sasquatches have, which are similar to humans. But it's because here's the difference. They are bipedal animals, just like humans are. Gorillas are knuckle walkers.
True.
And I think a lot of the human similarity that people see in these things, especially from a distance, their design is really a consequence of them walking on two legs. And the body will grow into a certain proportion with arms and legs of a certain length just simply by virtue that it walks on two legs. And that body design is the only thing that will allow you to balance yourself if you have those kind of human, you could say human-like proportions. No, they're just biped proportions. And they're bipedal, so they look that way, and we are bipedal, so we look kind of the same way, too.
Matt, your partner and friend Cliff Berrickman is with us, too. He's been talking with us about his thermal imaging technology. So you two make up a pretty good pair, Cliff, don't you think?
You know what? I'm lucky to have run into Matt when I did. Absolutely. I couldn't be doing it without Matt, honestly.
Matt, what do you think of the thermal imaging?
Oh, it's tremendous. I mean, it's one of those technologies, like, you know, with the advent of, you know, the microscope or the telescope, that will allow you to see into realms that you couldn't see into before. And we know that there's not just in this subject, but there's going to be a lot of things we think will be discovered because of thermal imaging, you know, being used and being applied in all sorts of different ways. So you can see a lot more animals at night with thermal imaging. More animals come out at night, but with that, you see into the darkness, into the woods, and, you know, anything that's alive just stands out like a supernova. And when people have used these imagers on expeditions, they are so much more at ease when they have one of these and they can see what's moving around them in the woods. Then once they use them once, they don't want to go out in the woods at night again without it.
Well, I've got to ask you, Matt, if you found one, what would you do?
Well, it depends on what you mean by if you found one.
Well, let's say you're out there on one of your expeditions. Thermal imaging shows that there's a creature out there. I mean, you're going to capture it. I know you're not going to shoot it, but
that's happened many times. We've come close. Well, you could say we've found one. We've gotten close.
What happens?
People have seen them. All you can do in those situations, first of all, they'll get on the radio and let us know that they can see one. What we've tried to do is just get units, move units toward them that can actually record, because very often, the units will have them where they're kind of hands-free and you can view through them and you can't record them, and it's kind of an elaborate system to hook up to a video recording unit, which has to be, it's in a backpack and the camera's on a helmet. We've tried to move units toward them, but yeah, what we would do is we would try to film it while the thing is still there. And that's, trying to capture one, et cetera. We know that'll happen down the line. One will probably be shot for scientific purposes, et cetera. But initially, at least, if a scientific organization is going to get, say, permission from the government to go do that, they're going to need to videotape one first. You know, just like with any animal in Africa or anything else. If you can't film one, then you're not going to be able to capture one.
So you're not going to do a King Kong and put him in some cage.
Not us. And certainly not now. We're going to have to get a heck of a lot more videotape for one before everybody in the organization, et cetera, that's working toward getting these things protected, before they would all say, okay, here we've got, say, an old one that doesn't seem to be there doesn't seem to be a family group around it, by virtue of lack of responses, etc. And we've only it seems to be one by itself, such that if this one were subdued or killed, etc., it's not going to impact another family group. There'd be a lot of things that would have to come ahead before we'd feel okay about doing that. For now, though, we know they are there, so it's important to just try to learn as much as we can when we, in these situations where we have some interactions. There's sometimes very fleeting interactions, but there's something really gratifying about taking people, some of which are just staunch skeptics, out into these situations, and boy, they turn around real fast on this subject when these things come around.
Oh.
Because it's obvious we're encountering some things that live out there, and they're still there when we're gone. And we, invite people to think, if you think that we set this up somehow, go ahead and come back on your own, and you'll see that the same things will happen, and then you'll know it wasn't us.
Are we getting more or less reports than we did 5, 10, 15 years ago, Matt?
I think what's happening now is that people are reporting them more often. And before, in the 70s, before the tabloids, which are now, we're just greatly celebrating because the Weekly World News is dead or is going to be over with. During that period, people were very discouraged from coming forward and talking about these things because it was like, people thought, well, you'd have to be a fool to believe that something like that is there. Because the tabloids had people thinking that there was just one of them and that it was a myth and that only, liars and hoaxers would report it. But now I think people are loosening up. They're seeing more documentaries on television. Maybe they're hearing about it, say, on your radio show. And they're starting to understand the subject with a little more complexity.
All right, Matt, you stay with us. We're going to open up the phone lines. Clifford, I want to thank you so much for being part of the program and giving us the information on the thermal imaging. We'll be back. We'll take your calls. Matt Moneymaker with us on Coast to Coast AM.